Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. And this is marks the ninth year that I've had the pleasure of doing this. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, Indoor Childhood is Bad for Kids by Ben Sasse. Then we have Alan Woodward's A Day on Earth is Getting Longer as the Planet's Rotation Slows. Alan Woodward wrote another article, Your Brain on Anesthesia Could Be More Like a Coma Than You Think. Megan Jacobs has The Taxpayer's Kitty Will Subsidize Yours, and we'll follow that up with Bert Stratton's Who Let the Dogs In? All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, Indoor Childhood is Bad for Kids. The digital revolution is remaking nearly every aspect of modern life. A top concern of parents, educators, and sociologists is screen time. How much is too much? The question points to a larger problem. American children are weirdly held hostage indoors. In theory, suburban neighborhoods offer the convenience of the city and the space to the country. In practice, it's too often the worst of both worlds. Our mostly suburban nation suffers the atomization of city living and the isolation of rural life. For kids, this means a life lived primarily indoors, sitting still. According to a new survey from the Institute of Family Studies, 60% of six-year-olds have access to internet-connected tablets, but 58% of kids that age are not allowed to play in their own yards unsupervised. Parents are busy, and they can neither can they nor should they be micromanagers. But when kids cannot entertain themselves outside, the screen becomes the babysitter. Things aren't better for older kids. At 11, 1 in 4 kids are not allowed outside without adult supervision. More than half of 14-year-olds do not have permission to leave their streets. This is new. For children trapped in America's industrialized school system, too much of life is defined by passivity. Adolescence should be an exciting coming-of-age period, a gradual transition to adulthood. If we do not give teenagers more responsibility, we're failing to prepare them for the world they'll soon leave. Nearly two-thirds of 17-year-olds cannot leave their neighborhoods without adult supervision. Is it reasonable to expect them to vote at 18, to fight a war, to incur college debt? Is it prudent to expect them to be ready to navigate a turbulent workforce being ripped apart by artificial intelligence? Obviously not. Rather than introducing children to the world in an age-appropriate manner, we're preventing them from developing imagination, resilience, and grit. Allowed to navigate dark corners of the internet on their own, many kids are bizarrely prohibited from exploring their own neighborhoods. This overprotection, however well-meaning, prevents children from learning valuable lessons like overcoming boredom, conquering fear, and taking risks. Of the 12 Apollo astronauts who walked on the moon, 11 were Boy Scouts who had learned to live by the Scouts' motto, be prepared. We're not raising these kinds of audacious risk takers at present. From westward expansion to space exploration, Americans have succeeded by pushing boundaries and embracing challenges. That kind of pioneer spirit starts with the adventures and misadventures of childhood. Stitches aren't all downside. Rather than complaining about kids these days or telling tales of an imagined past when baby boomer and Generation X parents walked to school uphill both ways, Americans need to reckon seriously with the choices we've made and the cultural implications of trapping an entire generation at home with few to no duties. We've eliminated opportunities for children to learn from low-risk failures and then tossed young adults into the deep end. The fault is not with kids. The failure belongs to us, their parents. Policy or legislation is not the solution, but the problem is solvable. The first step is developing an accurate and shared sense of the challenge. A significant reason for the next generation's addiction to screens is the current generation's failure to give them something better to do. We have not done the work required to build foundations of responsibility, independence, and discovery. As a result, screens become the easy default. Doing harder things will be more fulfilling. Cultural change starts at home and then moves out to neighborhoods, communities, and institutions. If we want to raise stronger, more resilient kids, we need to give them more freedom and demand more responsibility. And now a day on Earth is getting longer as the planet rotation slows. Ever feel like the days are dragging on longer? Turns out you're right. We think of a day as 24 hours, but recent research indicates that days are lengthening ever so slightly. Over the past two decades, day length grew by a rate of about 1.33 milliseconds per century, according to a study published in the Journal of Geophysical Research, Solid Earth. The change is happening because the Earth's rotation is slowing down. The culprit? Melting ice. As temperatures warm, ice in the Arctic, Greenland, and Antarctica melts. The newly liquid water shifts away from poles and into the ocean. The resulting rise in sea levels changes the speed at which the planet rotates. To understand why, think about figure skaters in a spin. When they pull their outstretched arms into the center of their bodies, they spin faster. That's because the speed of an object's rotation is influenced by its mass and where this mass is, said study co-author Benedict Sosa, a geoscientist at ETH Zurich in Switzerland. If the mass is further away from the object's rotational axis, imagine a string running between Earth's north and south poles, the rotation slows. We think we always have the same length of day, but with precise measurements, we see that's not the case, he said. This finding suggests Earth's days will eventually be longer than 24 hours, but that process will take millions of years, said study co-author and University of Vienna geoscientist Mostafa Kiami Shanbandi. The researchers calculated that the slowdown is happening at a rate unprecedented in 3.6 million years. Experts can calculate the Earth's rotation today with satellites and other techniques that measure the planet's movement. But to calculate this rotation millions of years ago, the study authors examined the chemical composition of fossils of ancient seafloor organisms that built their shells out of chemicals in the seawater. Changes in these chemical fingerprints correspond to changes in sea levels, which the scientists used to extrapolate day lengths. A change of milliseconds seems insignificant, but it can cause problems for our clocks, GPS, and navigation apps, and satellites that rely on accurate information about Earth's rotation. The slowing of Earth's rotation is not something that can be undone, said Sosha. Continued changes to the climate will likely cause bigger changes to day length by the end of this century, he added. We can slow down this trend, but we cannot really reverse it as of now. And now, your brain on anesthesia could be more like a coma than you think. One minute you're talking, the next you're out cold. But what's actually going on when you are under anesthesia? We often think of anesthesia as putting us in a deep sleep, But new research suggests it could actually be closer to being in a coma than previously thought. And there's still lots we don't know about how these drugs work on the brain, even though thousands of patients undergo a general anesthetic every day. In a recent study, researchers placed electrodes across the scalps of sedated patients, capturing their brain wave data. They compared those patterns against data from patients who were awake, asleep, or in a coma. The takeaway? The anesthetized patients' brains produced activity that shared similarity to being unconscious in a coma, as well as deep sleep, REM sleep, and patterns unique to anesthesia. It's a very strong perturbation of the system. This kind of profound manipulation of the brain, where a person goes from being highly cognitive functioning to basically unconscious, said Dr. Jana Heifrich, an anesthesiologist and neuroscientist at Yale University School of Medicine and co-author of the research published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The brain did not evolve to be anesthetized, so we want to understand how the brain comes back from it. Understanding these patterns could help doctors keep patients in a safer, more sleep-like state and reduce post-operative confusion and memory loss, according to Earl Miller, a professor of neuroscience at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who was not involved in this study. Anesthesia is considered safe, but there can be problems, some of them serious. Older patients or people with certain health conditions can experience neurocognitive issues after anesthesia, including memory or concentration problems, or post-operative delirium. Ultimately, gleaning what is happening in the brain could change anesthesia, helping it to be redesigned or personalized to a more closely resemble natural sleep rather than a coma-like one, Heifrich said. Could we maybe tweak anesthesia a bit more in the direction of sleep by using different medications or combinations or infusion protocols, she added? That would make anesthesia more healthy and better for the brain, and then we could avoid some of the cognitive side effects. And now the taxpayer's kitty will subsidize yours. Forget pro-natalist policy to support families. With New York becoming less and less affordable, state lawmakers are pushing subsidies for dog and cat owners. Progressives have long insisted that having a child is simply too expensive, requiring free daycare and refundable tax credits galore. In New York, apparently it's now financially impossible to own a tabby without state assistance. Bills before both the Senate and Assembly would institute a non-refundable tax credit for pet owners, and the sponsors would like to see it made refundable to maximize its helpfulness to lower-income residents. If that happens, the tax credit could in some ways outstrip what parents get from the state. While New York's child tax credit is income limited, anyone, regardless of wealth, would be able to get taxpayer money to cover dog and cat expenses. Even at the maximum amount, the child tax credit drops when a child turns 4 to about what you would get for FIDO. That per-child credit is $500, while the maximum payout for a pet-owning household would be $900 for 2 pets in the current bills. I love animals. I grew up with cats, dogs, birds, rats, and bunnies, and my husband and I have a mitt, Mercy, whom we love dearly. Despite our initial efforts to make her sleep in her bed, she's now a nightly fixture under our covers. So it tugs at my heartstrings to read about New Yorkers having to surrender their cats and dogs to shelters out of financial distress. But this is the classic cycle of big government. Pile on the regulations and taxes until voters are about to break, then offer some distortive new policy as a fix. It isn't by happenstance that New York has become the second most expensive state in which to own a dog, or that New York City shelters have been pushed past capacity by pet owners surrendering animals. When you pressure people with massive, non-negotiable expenses, energy costs 70% above the United States average, and the nation's seventh highest median home prices, they have to cut costs in other ways. As heartbreaking as it is to give up your dog, it is possible to live without one. Last year, the number one reason people surrendered dogs to the animal care centers of New York City was housing insecurity. That's not surprising in a city where 50,000 units sit empty because rent control has made it financially impractical for owners to rent them out. This is what happens when the government thinks it knows better than you how to spend your money. Instead of being able to devote a couple of $1,000s a year to a loyal furry friend, you're forced to hand over that cash to cover costs inflated by regulatory nonsense while paying some of the highest tax rates in the country. The stark result is that animals are put down that otherwise would not be. And now we have another article having to do with pets. Who let the dogs in? I have a no dogs policy. I'm a landlord. When I bought the building in Lakewood, Ohio, decades ago, a gigantic Doberman lived in apartment 400. It bounded down the stairs and almost ran me over. Also, the dog stained the oak floors by regularly urinating in the living room. So I kicked the dog out and the tenant and instituted a new policy. Cats are okay at an additional $20 a month. Yet I do have dogs in the building, emotional support animals. These are not trained service animals like those to help the blind. Tenants find a licensed social worker or a psychologist to write a letter saying the animal is needed for their mental health. The Fair Housing Amendments Act obligates the landlord to offer reasonable accommodation to tenants with disabilities, emotional and otherwise. Last month, a new tenant informed me she has two emotional support dogs. She brought this up after she had already moved in. She described the dogs as mixed breeds, about 20 pounds each. I immediately fantasized about changing my no dog policy to second dogs are okay at $500 a month. That would slow the pooch parade, but it would be illegal. The tenant texted me that Daisy and Miu are bonded and separating them would cause distress that would negatively impact my condition. Dog's owner also pointed out, my apartment is approximately 700 square feet, which is sufficient space for their size and needs. My tenant had done her homework, more than I had. I did not know you could have two emotional support dogs in a one bedroom. How about three dogs? The tenant said each dog has a unique function. One assists me with daily functioning and provides support when I leave home, whereas the other helps reduce anxiety and provides a sense of safety and stability within my home environment, particularly following a past traumatic experience. The tenant works in a restaurant, but everybody is a lawyer on the side, courtesy of AI. If the dogs are not quiet, I'll have to file an eviction for disrupting the neighbor's peaceful enjoyment of the premises. What a hassle. I am hoping the dogs are reasonable. The tenant is not. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I do look forward to being back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.